ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Global roaming. We did try to stay weekly. The news said no. So 5 days a week it is. I'm Hamish McDonald.
I'm Geraldine Doog, and now joined by esteemed colleagues Latika Burke and Kylie Morris. Search for Global Roaming on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Would there be a superhero of science uniform that you would have? What would the features be?
Oh, it'd be fairly daggy. Yeah, just the bush clothes with lots of pockets to put my notebooks in. And a daggy sun hat on my head.
Well, you're a superhero, so you could even have pockets that could hold infinite amounts of information.
Right.
That you could just pull out at any moment. I feel like that's what you're like anyway, Peter.
Well, that's called my brain.
Humans, herons, harlequin beetles, I present to you the brains of one of the members of nature's own Justice League, Peter Menkhorst.
This episode of What the Duck was made at a time when the Earth needs heroes. Eric was just an ordinary boy at 29 Acacia Road until he ate a banana. Then Eric is Banana Man. But we don't need more myths. No, we need real heroes. But where would they come from? I'm Anne Jones and this is Peter Menkhorst.
I'm a zoologist specialising in birds and mammals, particularly in Victoria, but across Australia.
A man whose first superpower is modesty, because Peter has literally written the field guides for birds and mammals of Australia. So, Peter, take us back to your planet Krypton. Where were you formed?
Nil is sort of on the edge of a patch of infertile sandy ground called the Little Desert. It's anything but a desert. It's really floristically diverse semi-arid heathland.
We're talking the Wimmera in Victoria, roughly halfway between Melbourne and Adelaide.
My father was a keen kind of field naturalist and photographer, and so the family spent quite a lot of time out in the Little Desert looking for wildflowers and orchids to photograph and looking at birds and just generally wandering around in the bush. I had three sisters and we had a little government supplied house in the town, but the life there was tremendous for kids. We had bikes and we could just ride wherever we wanted to, so me and my mates would just get on our bikes and ride kilometres and kilometres out of town and muck around. It was terrific. And in particular, we got interested in the mallee fowl that lived in the Little Desert.
Peter's talking about him and his dad, not his mates.
So these are megapodes. They lay their eggs in a huge heap of sand that they construct by scraping the sand up with their feet and also the litter from the floor of the scrub. And it's about a 7-month job every year for them to breed. They've got to manage this mound so that it gets hot enough to incubate their eggs, which so the female just lays her eggs, usually one per day, and up to about 20 or even 30 eggs in the centre of this mound. And then the male in particular, but both birds open and close the mound to maintain the temperature within the right range.
You are getting here a glimpse of the superpower held by Peter Menkhorst, an encyclopedic knowledge of the natural world.
Astonishing birds. We got pretty interested in them. So when I was, I think, 7 or 8, my father put up a hide next to an active mallee fowl mound. I have these clear memories of getting up well before dawn, travelling out to Kayata and sneaking into the hide before the sun got up, getting that real buzz of excitement when you see the bird in the frame of the camera, when it first walks up onto the mound and you get it in the frame and you manually focus and click the button. That was really exciting stuff. So I learned to keep quiet and still and to ignore mosquitoes and so on. It was something which has proven very useful throughout my career.
That's an amazing skill to have.
Did you have a birding Bible that you liked to cart around?
Yes, my father realised that I was getting interested in birds. I didn't have binoculars or anything. I learnt to watch carefully and stalk birds to get to see them well enough to try and figure out what they were. So he purchased a copy of What Bird Is That, written by Neville Cayley in the 1930s.
This book was pretty hefty, and Neville Cayley did the whole country a service by writing and illustrating it.
And in a way, that's the first field guide, bird field guide, in the world, as Penny Olsen points out in her biography of Neville Cayley.
It was pretty much the only illustrated bird guide in Australia for about 40 years.
And that was an incredibly successful and popular book, and lots and lots of families had a copy of What Bird Is That?
What did you think of it? Was it a good book?
Well, it was the only book at the time. Looking back at it now, it wasn't particularly good.
Shots fired, Neville Cayley. I hope you're listening from beyond the grave.
The text is informative and useful. The illustrations leave a bit to be desired.
I'm getting the impression by now that one of Peter Menkhorst's hitherto unknown superpowers is the inability to lie. Like, you could absolutely take him shopping and expect a realistic answer to how do I look?
Yeah, but it was all one head. So we made the most of it.
Yeah. And were you able to flick through and imagine the adventures to come?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I took What Bird Is That to bed and just sat in bed and read it, basically. Looked at all the illustrations and read the distribution descriptions.
For the first decade of his life, Peter lived in Neil with his sisters and parents, but his dad, who was a clerk of court, was then transferred to Melbourne. Was there a point where you thought, oh, wait a second, this could be a job, this could be a career for me?
Even after we came to Melbourne, my father and I used to go back to the Wimmera. We went and camped either at Kayata or in Wiperfeld National Park, which is to the north in the Big Desert. And one year we were at Wiperfeld, I must have been maybe 14, and there was another man there who we noticed had this fantastic camera gear. We got talking to him, and he turned out to be a chap named Len Robinson, who was, as we learnt, probably Australia's foremost bird photographer at the time. Mm. But he was camped at Wiperfeld at that time, wanting to photograph pink cockatoos and regent parrots and some of the really spectacular birds that occur in the Mallee country. My father and I had been going out there on this trip and finding lots of nests of parrots breeding in the ancient red gums out there in tree hollows. We got talking to Len and he said, well, I won't be using the hide tomorrow morning. Why don't you go and use it? Set up your camera gear in there, which we did, and we managed to get lovely slides of pink cockatoo and regent parrot. That was all very exciting. And then that evening we were talking around the campfire and Len said to me, you know, what do you want to do when you grow up? And really the only kind of people that I'd met who had jobs that I thought sounded really good was the national park rangers. But Len said to me, or said to my father, you know, no, he should go to university and study zoology. So that planted the seed of that there was a thing you could study called zoology and ecology.
It was an incredible stroke of luck that Peter and his dad met the man who took the first known photos of wild orange-bellied parrots and grey grass wrens and probably other species too, and that Menkhorst actually listened to the advice from that man. Because when he left school, he trundled off to Monash Uni to study zoology.
University was just fantastic for me. I only have a BSc. I didn't even do an honours year because I wasn't accepted. There weren't that many places back then.
Take heart, those who have faced rejection. Even the bloke who went on to write The Bird Guide has been rejected before.
But I managed to get a job, a temporary job, at what was then the National Museum of Victoria in the mammal department.
Not birds, mammals.
With the curator of mammals, Joan Dixon, who was a really good mentor for about 18 months while that job lasted.
Another side note, Joan Dixon is another legendary scientist, a taxonomist and collections manager, and a woman in scientific leadership throughout her whole career, a badass superhero of nature.
So I got that job and I thought this is a really good opportunity, so I never did get back to university.
That was also partially because of adventure calling for Peter, or should I say birds calling. Around 1975, Peter decides to take a trip to Papua New Guinea.
Yeah, that was a real adventure. So a mate that I met at university, Andrew Isles, who's now...
Yes, that was me gasping. Andrew Isles is another human with a legendary contribution in this area of science and naturalist culture in Australia.
Andrew Isles, who's now a natural history bookseller of international repute.
I mean, Peter's life is like a roll call of the who is who of Australia's nature elite.
He and I decided, let's go to Papua New Guinea.
As you do.
Yeah, well, we actually, at that time, 1975, Papua New Guinea was part of Australia. It was an external territory. So there were lots of Australians working there. And we just basically hitchhiked around or travelled on the Toyota utes that went up and down the main highways with people just paid a tiny sum of money and sat in the back of the ute out in the beating sunlight.
And what did you see? Because Papua New Guinea has got an amazing reputation for wildlife.
Yeah, but it's hard to find. I didn't really see many mammals. Most of the mammals I saw were dead, and in fact, some of them I was eating when we stayed with local people. And I'd try and pick the bones out of the stew so that I could attempt to identify what it was we were eating. We had a big book on the birds of New Guinea, which had keys, dichotomous keys, which allowed one to identify a lot of things.
A dichotomous key would have to be in my top three possible drag king names. But in this context, it is a way of laying out information in a sequence of questions. Is it fur or feathers, big or small? And the questions get more and more specific. Has it black or pink toe pads? Until, voila, you arrive at the species.
So that was really good training, actually, because it taught us to develop our powers of observation and our recording, note-taking of what it was we saw. So often we'd just be out in the rainforest or secondary forest around the villages and we'd see birds, we'd figure out what group of birds they belong to, take notes about the plumage and so on. And then in the evening we'd sit down with Rand and Gilead and try and key them out.
Wow. So these are like really core skills that would go on to become a really big part of your professional and personal life.
Yeah, it was really important. And to this day, I still carry around a notebook and a pencil and take notes, even though everybody's using apps on their phone to identify birds. I'd rather identify them myself than have some computer model tell me what it is.
Stone's thrown, Peter. Stone's thrown. So on the way home from PNG, what happened?
It was in December and I started thinking, I've just been in New Guinea for 6 months and I've got no job or anything. What am I going to do? So I've got the Saturday Age. In those days, if you wanted a job, it was an entire section with literally hundreds and hundreds of jobs every week. And I sat down on a picnic table in the Botanic Gardens and opened up the employment section. And I think I thought, let's start with Z for zoologist. And I might... that may not be actually true. I'm not sure. But anyway, I opened up the paper and I found this job. And it just read, Fisheries and Wildlife Department, Melbourne, Wildlife Survey Team, Mammalogist... And I just thought, wow, that is my job. I went back to the newsagents and I bought a writing pad and I sat down and just wrote out an application longhand and I put it in an envelope and posted it off. That just led to a 50-year career, really.
The past is a foreign country. The last job I put in for involved me wrestling a desktop computer while wrapping myself in university degrees and high jumping over organisational language backwards while blindfolded. Anyway, that is how Peter Menkhorst gets his start with the state government in Victoria.
For the first 10 or 12 years, we had pretty intensive field program. So we'd go out usually for 2 weeks at a time. So we'd have 10 or 11 days in the bush, sometimes camping, sometimes staying in the local pub or whatever. We had a team of people with 4 or 5 four-wheel drives and trailers of gear. And we would set lines of traps for terrestrial small mammals through the scrub. These are cage traps, so you catch the animal alive and you identify it in the hand, often weighing, measuring, maybe taking sket samples and then releasing them. And then that's the daytime bit. And then at nighttime we'd go spotlighting from the vehicle. So we worked long hours. And you have to get up early, of course, because you've got animals in your trap, because most Australian mammals are nocturnal.
What you're describing sounds beautiful and amazing and completely enthralling, but also that sounds exhausting.
Sometimes there were no animals in the traps at all.
Yeah.
And other times you just got very sick of smelly bush rats.
I mean, that's rude, but I understand. So how did you keep up with your bird interest? Like, it sounds like you're working 20-hour days at that stage.
Yeah, often 15 to 18-hour days.
Science superpower sneaking out there. Factual accuracy.
We'd do that for 2 weeks and then we'd be back in the office collating the information that we'd collected. And, of course, all the information was handwritten in notebooks. But at the same time, I was a member of the Victorian Ornithological Research Group, which is an amateur group that did bird banding and bird studies. We'd go catching shorebirds at night next to Melbourne's main sewage treatment plant, which is a fabulous area for birds that I've been involved in now for nearly 50 years on committees and things. So, yeah, I did my bird work on the weekends.
It's not superhero work, though, is it? Until there's someone or something to save. And the victims strapped to the train tracks in the case of Peter Menkhorst are creatures that I really hope you've heard of.
It took several decades to get the orange-bellied parrot, for example, into a place where it's not immediately threatened with extinction, maybe right now. The helmeted honeyeater has been reasonably successful, but that took more than 20 years to really make a difference there.
In his 45 years as a researcher, eventually with the Arthur Ryler Institute, Peter worked on koalas, blue-billed ducks, kangaroos, bristlebirds, brush-tailed rock wallabies, dingoes, glossy black cockatoos, hopping mice, islands as safe havens, the impacts of fire. Hell, Peter even wrote an absolutely legitimate report into the likelihood of a black panther stalking in Victoria. Conclusion, highly unlikely.
In my 40-something years at in the Victorian government, the number of ministers I served under is, I have lost count, actually, and the number of changes to departmental structure and all of that kind of stuff that goes on around you, it's very distracting at times.
I have a hypothesis here that the superhero skill of patience and fortitude that Peter learnt while he was getting eaten by mosquitoes in a bird hide might have played a part in his ability to work within government departments. Well said, Peter. But Peter's contribution is not just on the governmental side of conservation. By 1995, after decades of mammal surveys and a lifetime of bush time, Peter was sufficiently pleased with his notebooks that he could write a new guide, Mammals of Victoria, which was followed shortly thereafter by Mammals of Australia. This is no mean feat. There's something like 400 species of mammals to describe. But as if that was not enough, Peter is one of the authors of The Australian Bird Guide from 2017. How did a mammal expert write
the book on birds.
Really, I was approached from outside. There was a gentleman called John Manger. He had a lot to do with some of the classic bird books from Britain. He looked around at the Australian bird guides, and there are quite a number of bird guides in Australia, and they're very good, very high standard. But most of them were a bit old, primarily had been written back in the 1970s and 80s. And John thought there's a real opening here for a whole new field guide to Australian birds. So he set about trying to put together a team of artists and writers, and he ended up talking to Jeff Davies, who's absolute world-class bird artist. Got Danny Rogers and Rowan Clark, who are two Melbourne professional ornithologists, absolutely top-class birders. Rowan has seen more Australian birds than anybody, and Danny knows more about migratory shorebirds than just about anybody. So between the three of us, you know, we covered the spectrum fairly well.
What does it actually involve when you go to write a field guide? Did you have to open up those notebooks and flip back through all your observations?
Not so much. We made a decision right at the start that we wouldn't look at the other bird guides. It's very hard not to be influenced by the other guides that we'd all been using fairly intensively for decades. You know, we made a list of the species. It was the first job. Had to decide which species go on which page, because a bird field guide is a very highly structured book. We wanted it to be. So you have to decide which species go together and what illustrations do we need for each species. There's something like 2,400 illustrations in the Australian Bird Guide. That was the first task. What species go on each plate? And what will we illustrate for each species? And then on the opposite page to the plate, we'd have the text. And so the number of species that had to be fitted in the page determined how many words you had for each species. And then you had to leave room for the distribution maps.
So it's a real work backwards. I didn't realise.
Yeah, it's very exacting work. Then you have, okay, we've got whatever it was, 350 words roughly for each species. What are the key things that we need to say? And then how do we say those things in the space available? And it took years. It took 10 years to actually, from when I first spoke to John Manger to when the bird was published was literally 10 years.
So much work, and so appreciated by me anyway. I love field guides. But Peter, do you keep a list of the bird species that you have seen?
I do.
One way that some people rank ornithologists is by the number of species they've seen. This can be a point of pride, it can be a sore point, or it can completely miss the point. So what's Peter's number?
Oh, it's not very good. It's only in the 600s, not even 700. It's hopeless.
Hardly. That's over 600 species of birds that Peter has laid eyes on in Australian territories.
I don't know what it is, 658 or something. I'm not an obsessive twitcher by any means, so I don't rush around. You know, if something turns up in Broome, I don't jump on a plane and fly to Broome to see it. But I keep a list. I started writing a list when I was probably, well, I know when it was. It was in 1964, so no, I was 11 probably. And I've still got that book. I guess I was writing out a list of birds that I'd seen around where we lived in Melbourne. And I think my grandmother saw that, and she went and she came back with a hardcover notebook and said, use this, and because you won't lose it and it'll keep longer. I've just continued using that exact same book since 1964. And each time I see a new species in Australia, I just write down the name and the place and the date. And yeah, I've kept that going for, 60 years.
Your grandmother was right. It did last a lot longer than a bit of paper.
Yes. Yeah.
Congratulations to Peter Menkhorst on his recent retirement from public service and his subsequent 24-hour-a-day birdwatching habit. May there be many more notes to be made and many, many more pockets to stash the notebooks. What the Duck is made by Rebecca McLaren and me, Anne Jones, for ABC Radio National on Wadawurrung and Taungurung country, the lands of the Kulin Nation.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.